This is Julianne Nighan. It is the 10th of July 2004. I'm 2014. I'm interviewing Professor Manfred Thaler, and we're at the Digital Humanities Conference. So the first question is, and I'm interviewing for the Hidden Histories Project. Mm-hmm. The first question is your earliest memory in any context at all of encountering computing or computing technology.
I assume computer technology within the humanities. Well, in approximately my third or fourth year at the university, which must have been something like 73 or so, we had a working group of students who invited people outside the normal context to present what then was considered innovative approaches to history. And there we had a presentation of somebody who used a pre-runner of what later would be called a database to map the occurrence of medieval coins.
Okay. And did you find it interesting?
Oh yes, it was definitely interesting, but I didn't have any immediate application for it in the kind of work I made.
Hmm. And was this seen as an unusual presentation or a new type of presentation, or would it have been par for the course at that stage?
No, that was definitely highly unusual at the time. And it was also in no way covered at what you would have heard at the university regularly. That really was just a presentation to people who had shown unusual interest. In history in general, not in this specific topic.
What was your first engagement with the humanities computing community of the time?
Well, how far a humanities computing community existed in 1976, when my active work in the area started, is a bit doubtful, particularly in Austria. My first professional contact has been to a historian of a family, not in the sense of genealogy, but the development of structures of family, like the Cambridge group did in England, in Vienna, in early 1977, where I immediately was hired because the professor had approached me, as he had heard that I was doing some computer work for other historical projects.
And what kind of research did you do on the project?
That was a standard statistical calculations of demographic behavior.
I wanted to ask you to reflect a little when it came to the time that you started leading your own research projects.
Mm-hmm.
And the factors that led you to include the computer in that, or to theorize about the role of the computer in that research also?
Well, that's a different story. My own doctoral thesis dealt with roughly the history of a mentality, or more properly, how opinions would be created out of the information available at the time. For that purpose, between 1973 and 1975, I filled roughly 32,000 index cards with excerpts from approximately 500 years of newspapers, which certainly was impressive, but impressed upon me that it was not very simple to handle such stuff. And after finishing my doctorate, I had the possibility to get a scholarship for a 2 years post-doctoral training at the Institute for Advanced Studies in Vienna, which offered such courses in empirical social science, even to people who had no formal training in social science. There I encountered statistical standards software and found that while this was interesting, the statistical paradigms could not be applied sensibly to historical data without undergoing certain transformations from the stage in which the stuff was kept on in the sources. This led me to the decision to do, besides the application of statistical software, some programming exercises in Snowball, which led very, very early, actually, something like 4 weeks after I started programming, into an involvement with a project on the daily life of the Middle Ages, where at that time at a research institute where one of my friends worked, projects had started to create a collection of all the surviving medieval images in an area roughly coincident with today's Austria and some of the neighboring countries, which had started approximately at 1 or 2 years earlier. The idea there was to create a database which would use these images not for purposes as art historians use them, but for historical purposes, that is, for the study of the daily life, of the material aspects of a daily life, which meant that you had to represent the content of these images. That was still the punch card time, and digitizing them, at least with the equipment we had available at that time, was completely out of the question. And my first exercise in applied programming then had been to build a software to administer these descriptions of images controlled by a command language which was supposed to be sufficiently far from a computer that the people working at that research institute actually could use it themselves. Where, of course, one has to say that usability requirements in 1976 were slightly lower than they have developed in the meantime.
Am I right in saying that in the Institute for Advanced Studies you had access to formal training in programming?
No. We had formal training in statistics and some in mathematics. But for formal training in computer usage simply consisted in how to use SPSS. What went beyond that, well, was based on the formal advice that Snowball, which nobody else at the Institute had ever used, was suspected to be particularly useful for what I had in mind. And then I simply had to learn the language myself.
You had to learn it yourself. Will you please reflect a bit on that, on that process of self-teaching and mm-hmm. how you went about it, what it entailed? Was there a social element to it at times?
Well, that's there are simply people who learn in different ways. I think for me it was highly effective. I remember that a few years later when I went to the place where I later had my first long-term permanent job, I was basically reading a description of a programming language, PL1, and I simply started thinking how nice it would be to realize certain things with that. And I really think that how you learn things is very, very, very much a personal matter, which is the reason why until today I'm a bit suspect of didactics, because some people like it very much to learn programming by trying things out themselves. Other people need a group of three or four reference persons with which they can talk about it, which is the reason that in the meantime, when teaching computing formally and teaching programming formally myself, I try not to impress a model of how people have to learn more than is absolutely necessary to keep classes consistent.
Okay. But you would have had, you did not as such take a formal training?
No.
What was your first digital humanities conference that you attended?
Sorry?
The first digital humanities conference that you attended.
The first digital humanities conference, the one you probably would mean,
the first humanities computing would be more precise way of saying it.
Okay, well, the first AHC conference was 1982 at Pisa, but my first conference which dealt with computing in parts of the humanities was 1977 in Cologne. Where there has been a conference of what still is called Quantum, which is a membership-driven group which at that time was working very intensively with quantitative methods in history. The reason why my voice became slightly slow when I said membership organization is simply that after the very few first years, it basically evolved into a group of people which still publish a journal in the field, but there's not very much happening beyond that. In those years, they organized summer schools themselves, in which I've also been heavily involved.
People frequently comment to me that when they attended, labels are always so difficult, but when they attended, you know, sort of humanities, computing, digital history, so on, these gatherings, that the community was always very open and welcoming, and the type of spats and arguments that one may see in more established disciplines, that they didn't tend to be as apparent. And I wondered whether you would agree or disagree.
Oh yes, I totally agree with that. I mean, that was very clear that well, not all of the people were young in that group, but the mean age probably was something like 30, possibly even below. And it was very clear that the people at these conferences considered themselves if not as a group of, as an elite, at least as a group of revolutionaries who grumbled against the conservative people trying to keep away from the interdisciplinary work, which at that time was rather innovative in many humanities disciplines.
Did you present your digital humanities research also at pure history conferences? Your digital history research?
Oh, yes, yes. We still linking back to Austria since 1979. I was part of an Austrian-based group which was most recognizable by organizing a series of summer schools in Austria which ran between 1978 until the early 90s. which at the same time also organized regular workshops or sections at the annual Historians Conference in Austria. This I remember rather clearly because it was a whole series of events and we were present at each of the Historians Conferences for a decade or so, while from something like 78 onwards, I also quite frequently presented the work I did in the meantime at all sorts of historians' conferences, but there have been too many of them that I have a very clear memory when I presented what.
What kind of reception did you see? Did you receive, especially from those who were not using computing in their research?
Well, I would say for about a third of the people, this was seen as a positive development, though there was slight reserves about the feasibility of it all. Roughly a third of the historians more or less did not indicate any interest, and there was a hardcore of historians who at that time considered computation as a kind of vulneration against the principles established by Ranke. But that is a very mixed matter, because in the early days of quantitative history, the assumption was not so much one of usability of computers or of publishing something, but the assumption by the convinced quantifiers was that you simply could produce better historical results with statistical methods, where the usage of a computer was only a secondary aspect, than you could do without using quantitative methods. So the misery of historicism was a very widely quoted work, approvingly by quantifiers, and as a side effect, there were historians who were clearly against it. But on the other hand, one also should not say that this describes the front line only partially, because as early as this first wave of quantitative work, there have been a couple of research projects in history which use decidedly non-quantitative work, like, for example, trying to identify the agreement between witness lists of medieval charters, which were implemented by some of the more, if not most, methodologically conservative medievalists in Germany, which did not see any problem with it, as long as it was clear that the methodological and conceptual framework of their work would not be endangered.
As you look back on your career and these, I guess, shifting movements to some extent, do you view the process of using the computing in history as one of having moved from the margins towards the mainstream, or how would you characterize that process?
Well, I mean, I consider it's a kind of, it's really a kind of circular process. We had a couple of very important events. For example, the event of easily available quantitative methods with the arrival of SPSS and similar programs, the arrival of easily usable databases together with PCs, and the arrival of easily usable web publication possibilities or web services in something like 95. And there have been similar indications of a new wave in the last 5 to 7 years, where it is not yet so clear what the primary type of application will be. At the stage of each of these introductions of a new method, two things happened which ran a little bit against each other. On the one hand, at each of these stages, the number of computer applications in history increased by about one order of magnitude. On the other hand, the methodological conceptual refinement dropped sharply. I mean, that can be very simply described with, when we talk about the advent of personal computer. Before 1985, quantitative studies usually meant that you would have to do a statistics course, and then you would apply statistical software which created tables, coefficients, and other things which you would have to interpret to get any insight from it. And relatively many historians were very, very skeptical how these figures could actually show something. There are some very good reasons why you can be doubtful about quantitative studies in history. There are other reasons which are not so good. But there was certainly a skepticism among many historians. The interesting thing which happened when the PC was invented is that together with it, there came very simple-minded statistical programs, which however had the possibility to create graphic representations of statistical data very, very easily. And the first 3 years of the introduction of PCs into history departments have produced a flood of pie charts which were totally unrefined, and some of them did show absurd things because the data going into them were beyond recovery because they never had been clarified, but they made pie charts suddenly very, very popular. Well, after people had played with PCs for something like 3 to 5 years, it turned out that things were not quite as simple as we had seen in the meantime, and the methodological refinement increased again because people accepted that even if you had the computer on your desk, you needed more than a passing acquaintance with what happened in the software if you actually wanted to use it. And if one would go into detail, you could show exactly the same thing with the first web projects, where you had an explosion of people using the computer, but for some of the web pages which were created at that time, it's rather good for everybody's reputation that they haven't been preserved so well.
Yeah, this is about the last one again. When you look back at it. Who influenced you? And this can be as much in terms of traditional historians as mm-hmm. humanities computing people. But so when you look back at your main influences, who were they?
Well, it's a shame, but it's relatively hard to remember the names. Unfortunately, I have a very bad memory for names, so I would have to look up some of the books which I vaguely remember. I'm afraid I can't point to any specific name. What influenced me very much as a journal was Historical Methods, a journal which had its heyday in the 70s until 80s, and at that time did show produce very much about the usage of computers, and particularly the usage of computers for non-quantitative purposes in history. I'm not quite sure if the journal may still be appearing. I haven't looked for it recently because after the end of the 80s, it turned its focus mainly towards anthropology and to interpretative interdisciplinarity, not so much to the formal methods. But that's probably the one thing which influenced me most directly.
What is the name of the journal?
Historical Methods.
Historical Methods.
It's, I think, since 72 onwards or 74 onwards, I don't know. Yeah. Now, what influenced me more systematically were simply the working conditions which I found at the place where I had my first long-term work, which is the Max Planck Institute for History in Göttingen. There I was originally hired for a rather specific project, which was supposed to be complex social history analysis based on things called family reconstitutions or extended family reconstitutions for specific types of economic and social history. Now, Max Planck Institutes are pure research institutes, which are actually not connected to a university, and the director of that institute at that time, Mr. Fierhaus, let his people have very, very great leeway. So the assumption was basically, well, you are supposed to be visible worldwide, and your competition, whosoever is best in this discipline, otherwise you can do more or less what you want to do. Fortunately, this approach was a little bit backed up by resources which were available, which meant that in the late 70s, early 80s, I had the possibility relatively systematically to buy all the literature which was available at that time. Now, in pre-Amazon times, all the literature that was available at that time probably wasn't very much more than something like 50 titles or so, but this simply meant that I had access to all the conference volumes which have been published since the early 60s about the early stages of humanities computing all over the field. The other big thing which influenced me, which is also immaterial, is that Max Planck is an institution which has humanities institutes, but which is primarily a hard science institute. Sorry, not an institute, but a collection of something like 80 institutes which run joint infrastructures. And these infrastructures assumed that people should have the computing capacities and devices they needed, quite irrespective from which institute they came from. Why this is important, I can describe by telling you an anecdote which at that time left me with a deep shock. Within the early 80s, our work on social and economic history has led to databases which had roughly a size of something like 200 megabytes, which at the moment seems to be relatively trivial. At that time, as will become clear in a moment, is rather large. And I could do that as somebody who had just finished his 30th year, because I belonged to an institute which was supposed to be entitled to use computing resources, period. When my position became permanent, I went to the US on a 3 weeks journey where I basically went to a dozen or 14 people at universities all over the US, including Harvard. I'm very sorry that I can't pick up the name at the moment, I can look it up. But in Harvard at that time, there was an extremely prominent social historian or economic historian who had done one of the very first studies of Italian censuses and was truly famous for the first fully quantitative study of Tuscan or Pisan census of one of the first censuses of the first year. So I entered the holy halls of Harvard, met one of the great men of the field, and wanted to talk to him what he thought about computer technology. And the answer was that he became very, very enthusiastic because Harvard had just made extraordinary capabilities available to him, more precisely a 10 megabyte hard disk, where he only would have found the money for a programmer so he could actually use that. So this is a bit unfair, but the possibility to have access to all the resources I could dream up purposes for has probably influenced me much, much more than any specific article or paper I've been reading.
In a way that doesn't surprise me. It sounds like a truly amazing, a dreamlike scenario almost.
Sorry?
It sounds like a dreamlike scenario.
Well, yes, that's
wonderful.
I mean, it may be a dream scenario for people in the humanities nowadays, but if you look at the capabilities at research institutes in computer science, that is actually a well-tried principle, make resources available on for people, force them to produce results, but don't hinder them by counting bytes or bandwidth or other nice things.
Absolutely. And at the Max Planck Institute in Göttingen, were other humanist people working also in that?
Yes. There were people, first of all, working on something called proto-industrialization. Proto-industrialization is defined at the phase when when artisanry in agricultural areas was by various economic constructions converted into a system where a relatively large portion of available income was also produced by the systematic production of items, particularly in the textile pre-industry or proto-industry. And there are all sorts of theories about how that was connected with social behavior and similar things. Now, my task, and that was exactly the job I was hired for, was to create a computer system which should be able, roughly, to take the marriage registers of a city, of a village, find out which children belong to which marriage, which death record belongs to the individual people, which is called a family reconstitution, and then to augment that by just about any conceivable source which contained names, lists of taxation, property lists, and various other stuff. Bear was indeed somebody who indirectly influenced me very much, though not in detail, because David Sabian, who in the meantime I think has retired in LA, was not following things up very much himself, but he most certainly had very visionary ideas which forced the necessity to connect really every conceivable source to that kind of system which was being developed. This forced me at a relatively early stage to think relatively general, because it was not a limited set of sources to be processed, but every conceivable source which might exist. And given my experience from Vienna to build systems which, at least in theory, should be used by the researchers themselves, let me then invent a programming system, Clio, which some people still remember because it's probably the only modestly widely used system with a command language in Latin, which in any case was rather general and could be used for, well, theoretically all types of historical sources. Then something happened which is relatively typical for that type of project. While the data arrived, and while everybody was very happy that his data would be processed, people actually finished other books or wrote other articles and more or less postponed the analysis of the data which were prepared for them. And at that time I somehow decided that if this was so, and that was something supported by Mr. Fierhaus, the director of the institute at that time, then I would simply ask people at other institutes whether it would not be possible to use some of their data to test out features which we had implemented, where I have to admit again the possibility to use what for all practical purposes were unlimited computing resources helped, which meant that within a relatively short period of something like 5 years, what originally had been clearly a supportive function for a specific number of research projects gained the status of an abstract research project on its own, simply geared towards building a general software system for historical purposes, for which I invented the term source-oriented data processing. Behind that term was the assumption that previous software, like for example SPSS, was focused on making a specific canon of methods, quantitative methods, analytical quantitative methods to be precise, available more or less by the researcher, him or herself. Source-oriented database, as I understood them, or source-oriented data processing, as I understood it, meant that he would try to take historical sources and try to convert everything, I hope you heard the quotes, which a source possibly contains, into a form which then could be analyzed for various purposes. That was going on for something like 5 years or so, at the end of which this research project had emancipated itself so far from the ones which should be supported originally that I got a grant from a funding agency which allowed to start a new implementation of that software, which was not implemented in PL1 anymore, but in the programming language C, which at the middle of the 80s was not completely new anymore, but still one of the newer ones. And a point of that project was to make it as widely available to the research community as possible. This coincided with the availability of personal computers, and in the middle of between the middle of 80s, or between, well, the implementation of that version actually started in 87, and approximately 10 years later we worked on that software for a very short number of years, and also made it available by providing summer schools, which at the height of the development brought something like 100 people together for 2 weeks to show how you could handle historical sources based on that type of software. The only problem was that such funded research still is, it was heavily limited in time. So the actual development grant for the software, which had been developed, ran for only something like 3 years, with a fourth year glued on. And afterwards, to develop the software further, we had to look for research projects which would allow us to develop it in the content, in the context of content-driven research. There have been quite a few of these, one of which, for example, involved some early work on making the content of archives of the former concentration camp at Auschwitz available. But the scope was really very, very broad. This is chronologically probably wrong now because it's a bit earlier, but at some stage we also did work on comparison of the shape of medieval pottery, which has relatively few commonalities with documents at Auschwitz. But simply also has some data structures which can be supported if you have software which operates at the right level of generalization.
When you look back at the ways that the computer was used in these projects, mm-hmm. what were your disappointments and your...
My big disappointment actually was not in, well, there were a couple of disappointments in the way interaction went. This of course is still one of the big problems of interdisciplinary work, that if at some stage you are interested in developing a software product, not because you personally want to see the results, but you want, because you want to test out some formal idea of what you can do to information, which is the reason that at that time, in my perception, at some stage I crossed the invisible line between history and computer science. Because after some time, I simply got interested in the problems of formalizing historical studies, just because I was interested in these problems and not because I wanted to implement a specific study. And at that stage, as is usually the case in interdisciplinary projects between computer science artists and humanists, there very, very frequently started that misunderstanding that when somebody from the formal part of the world wants to test something, they think that they should provide a system which people could use later on in their own projects. And it is very frequently the case that people developing software get into the habit of doing it just once more themselves to spare the time needed for the people who are interested in the content to learn how to do that, so the tools for that might already be available. That is, from a computer science point of view, if you have developed a solution, you have developed the solution, and you would be very happy if other people apply it. From a humanist's point of view, if a computer scientist develops a solution, you usually expect him or her also to apply it sufficiently long that you have the results you can interpret. That was definitely a kind of disappointment, but the more serious disappointment, which I still think is is something which has damaged parts of the humanities, is that in the 90s there was a move away from working with formalized results. And I have a strong suspicion that that simply relates to the fact that if you want to study a phenomenon formally, I do not say quantitatively, because my own work had moved far away from quantification already in the late 80s, but if you want to work on a humanities problem formally, computers have the obnoxious habit of telling you time and time again that your data may contain errors, or that there's actually something which does not really fit your hypothesis. So it's a long and painstaking process. While if, on the other hand, you go into an archive and find a document with a human appeal and publish it and add a clever interpretation to it, this is on the one hand much, much faster, and on the other hand much less frustrating. And to my sorrow, the historical research has certainly fallen into what I consider a trap by getting away from the necessity to do those types of research which are harder to do. But on the other hand, one has to say that there was, of course, a very serious change in the 90s with the advent of both the possibility to handle images as well as with the possibility to use web services, which in my opinion are still not completely understood. Still cooperating with that Austrian Institute, which I had my first contract from in 76, we entered image processing, that is digitization, image enhancement, pattern recognition, in 88 or 89, working on Unix workstations, and built up quite some image handling capabilities in that software I'm referring to. Now, when we did that, I was at a very early stage interested in the possibilities of making sources available for interpretation widely. So at the AHC conference, or well, ALLC conference, I should say, at Siegen in 89, if I remember correctly, we presented a workstation with this kind of software I'm talking about, which among other things also did show a very, very early version of this image processing software. And at the same time, we were very interested in what you could do with digitized documents. And at that approximately that stage, we started a project which, for me, had an extremely interesting result. We got a research grant in the middle of the 90s, which allowed us to digitize a substantial amount of manuscripts, something like 60,000 pages or 70,000 pages, and make them available over the internet. This was really early, and I, though it is childish, I still remember with some amusement on one occasion sitting on a panel beside a representative of the Library of Congress in Washington, who unveiled with great pathos the first version of the George Washington papers. And I had immediately afterwards the possibility to point out that the not so widely known city of Duderstadt in Lower Saxony had about twice as many pages in the internet on fairly obscure material from the 15th century. But this is just saying we were very early with it. The strange thing which I discovered was that we worked under two assumptions in that project. On the one hand, that what would make the applications of computers particularly interesting was that you could read some of the documents provably better on the screen than in the original for image enhancement and various other things. Secondly, we assumed that if you offered such material as digitized manuscripts in a large scale, in parallel, you should look at possibilities to provide editorial techniques together with it. So while this archival stuff was the main point of the project, we had a separate section where we implemented a possibility to handle manuscript variants in a way which is more meaningful than the typical grid, well, which basically nobody can really read to see some effects. What in hindsight I'm not quite sure might have been a mistake was that we accompanied that project with an attempt to connect very, very, very closely back into the user community. So in the 3 years the project was running, we had a public presentation every 12 months and discussed the results achieved so far. And during these 3 years, where we followed up to a degree the feedback from the users community, we discovered that actually the possibilities to handle the images for enhancement or various other things were interesting. But what the people really got excited about was the possibility to have very great amounts of source material available on the internet, and to have, well, conceptually a couple of 100,000 pages available at your fingertips, for it was only 70,000 at that stage. So all the analytical ideas we had were actually dropped in favor of improving access to the material. And I find it quite significant if I look at the development of digital editions in general, that you can discover a very strange phenomenon. At the middle of the 90s, digital editions in general were usually connected to CD-based systems, which had a couple of very nice features, which probably haven't been surpassed by most of the systems you have nowadays. And then great amounts of data became available on the internet. At the same time, you notice that the interest in digital editions actually dropped, because those people who were interested in applying technical innovation into the humanities became mainly caught by the same trap we might have been caught, that is, that the sheer exuberance of accessibility drowned out the analytical possibilities which might be there, which is in some ways strange and has led to a couple of things where I really wonder how long they will take. It is quite obvious at the moment, and there are papers which I've written already in the 90s which discussed that. It's quite obvious at the moment that there's actually not very much point of ever finishing an edition in the humanities. Because howsoever good the edition is, you can be absolutely sure that beyond a certain intensity of usage, the users will try to go back to the manuscripts. Well, still, for some strange reasons, people think of editorial processes as something which ends at a given stage, for which there simply are no technical reasons anymore. I mean, if you would concentrate on editions in the internet not as tools for presenting a final result of a working process, but as an intermediate stage which could be taken up again at any stage, we would actually use the medium much more to its characteristics. And I really wonder how long it will take until what I consider simple technical and artisan-like implications of a printed media will be dropped in favor of adopting the possibilities which the new media create.
I know it's astonishing to see how slow this process is. To think we're still trapped in this almost incubator kind of stage. Okay, I've kept you for the best part of an hour, so I'm going to ask one more question, if that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, so when you left Max Planck, then did you go straight to the Uni Göttingen, or?
No, when I left Max Planck, which was at Göttingen, I first went a couple of years to Norway, where originally I had something highly unusual, a kind of part-time professorship. That's a Norwegian mechanism by which you can connect people to a university either out of industry or, for example, from other countries, which you would want to have in your department for shorter periods of time. Then I did a couple of bit of teaching, in history connected to digital methods. And as an outcome, I was then asked to direct a merger of three independent research units at the University of Bergen, which covered the whole scope from editorial philology right through to, museum information system. So that was a fairly large unit, which when it had been merged, was something like a 30-person infrastructure for IT usage in the humanities at the in the University of Bergen. Originally, I definitely had understood this to be a long-term assignment, but I have to admit that it had one shortcoming. While I endorsed this task very much, it was also clear that by that step I had converted from somebody doing active research into a research manager, which had its own rewards. But when Cologne then offered a professorship for computer science for the humanities, where I had the possibility to build up my own study programs and also attract funding for projects I could get involved personally rather than only managing them. This had so much attraction that I went south again, ending up at the Rhine instead of at Göttingen.
Yeah. Okay, no, I simply got confused. Even how I could confuse the two, I don't know. But so just to close, so what were the main differences in terms of the access to resources, the kind of social structures you had around you, and between being in the Max Planck and then moving to the professorship?
Oh, well, that's totally different. I mean, at Max Planck, I had absolutely no contact with students originally. But on the other hand, I may hold a few records for side teaching assignments when working at a research institute, because as this kind of work was somewhat unusual, I think I collected teaching assignments at more than a dozen universities during my years at Max Planck, and I've been very heavily involved in summer schools. Now, this may have been not necessarily a very good qualification for taking over a regular professorship, because that meant that I mainly encountered students who were more than normally interested in their field and particularly interested in applying new methods, where without wanting in any way to offend my Cologne students, going from that to a normally motivated group of students certainly needed some adjustments. And the other thing is, of course, that at Max Planck, funds were considerably more easily available at regular university, though I have to say that in a sense, I think I can call myself extremely successful at inviting third-party funding for funded research while being at the University at Cologne. On the other hand, that may have brought me out of focus of my original purposes, because out of creating historical databases, it was very simple in drifting into digital libraries, particularly because it was easier to get funding for digital libraries than for historical databases. And out of digital libraries, it was particularly easy to drift off into digital preservation, because that was relatively simple to fund. And that may have brought me further from my original analytical interests than I ever wanted at any of these drifts slightly away from the last line.
Okay, so I could ask more questions, but I won't, because we've been here for a time. So is there, unless there's anything that you want to add that might be?
Oh, no, not really.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Okay, it's been a pleasure.